We turn now to, well, I have to say, one of my favorite figures in church history, the Scotsman John Knox. Knox was born in 1514 south of Edinburgh in the small burgh of Haddington. At the age of just 15, he entered the University of St. Andrews to study, no, not golf, theology. After 7 years, he was ordained a Roman Catholic priest and became a notary since his studies specialized in the law. Being a gifted speaker, he was employed as a tutor for the sons of some of the local lairds. It's a term that refers to the lower rung of Scottish nobility. Now, dramatic events unfolded in Scotland during Knox's youth. Many were angry with the Roman Church, which owned more than half of the land and gathered an annual income of almost 20 times that of the crown. Bishops and priests were more often than not political appointments, many of them so morally corrupt they didn't even try to hide their debaucheries. Cardinal Beaton, Archbishop of St. Andrews, openly consorted with concubines, fathering 10 children. The constant traffic between Scotland and Europe saw much Protestant literature being smuggled into the country, and church authorities were alarmed by the pernicious German heresy, as they labeled the Reformation. They tried to suppress it. Patrick Hamilton, an outspoken Protestant convert, was burned at the stake in 1528. The smoke from Hamilton's martyrdom, it was said, quote, infected all it blew upon, unquote, meaning that his death only multiplied Protestant sympathies rather than crushing them. In the early 1540s, while tutoring the sons of Protestant families, Knox came under their influence, and at the preaching of Thomas Guillaume, he joined them. Knox then became a bodyguard for the firebrand Protestant preacher George Wishart, at that time touring Scotland. Knox carried a two-handed sword while guarding Wishart, quite the image of the future reformer. In 1546, Cardinal Beaton had Wishart arrested, tried, and strangled. And just to make sure that everyone knew how angry he was, he had Wishart's body then reduced to ashes. The Protestants decided such outrage could not go unanswered. And so 16 Protestant nobles stormed the castle, assassinated Beaton, mutilated his body in retribution for what he'd done to Wishart, who posthumously could wonder, hey, where these guys had been earlier? You know, it might have been a little bit smarter for them to take the castle when he was still alive. With the castle now in Protestant hands, a fleet of French ships arrived and they laid a siege. Catholic France was an ally to Catholic Scotland. Though Knox was not party to the cardinal's murder, he did approve of the action and, during a break in the siege, joined the besieged inside the castle to show solidarity with them. Now, the siege wasn't your typical surrounding of a castle where the attackers then try to starve the besieged into submission. It was really half-hearted, kind of a partial siege. It was more about appearances than an earnest attempt to bring the cardinal's killers to justice. And so life wasn't really disrupted for the people in the castle all that much. Things went on pretty much as normal. Then, during a church service one Sunday, Protestant preacher John Rough spoke on the election of ministers. And he turned to John Knox and asked if he would please take on the office of resident preacher. When the congregation confirmed the call, Knox was overwhelmed and reduced to tears. At first, he declined, thinking himself unqualified, but eventually he submitted to what he came to regard as the call of God. It was a, I have to say, short-lived ministry. In 1547, the siege of St. Andrews ramped up, and the Protestants had to surrender. Some were imprisoned, while others, like Knox, were made galley slaves, which, if you know anything about, well, that sends a shiver right up your spine. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a lower lot for a man to sink to, an ironic post for a man who had just wept in humility at being called to pastor a church. For 19 brutal months, Knox pulled an oar chained to a French galley. The conditions were simply inhuman. Rowing in all weather, beaten if the pace slackened, barely fed. During this time, when a picture of the Virgin Mary was thrust in Knox's face, he was ordered to kiss it for good luck. Knox refused and reportedly threw it into the sea, saying that Mary could swim to shore. That nearly cost him his life. But it shows the steel in Knox's spine, even in the darkest of circumstances. And years later, Knox would say that when he rode past the coast of Scotland and saw St. Andrews in the distance, he told his fellow prisoners, quote, I am fully persuaded, how weak soever I now appear, that I shall not depart this life till my tongue shall glorify God's name in the same place, unquote. And a year and a half passed before Knox and his fellow galley slaves were released. That they lived a year and a half was a miracle in itself. Knox spent the next 5 years in England, and his reputation for preaching boomed. He served as a royal chaplain to the young King Edward VI and was even offered a bishopric, which he refused. His fiery preaching and uncompromising Reformed theology made him one of the most influential preachers in England. Now, when the Catholic queen, Mary Tudor, inherited the throne in October of 1553, Knox fled to France. It was a smart move, since Mary did her best to reverse the path towards Protestantism that her brother had followed. She executed so many that she's known to history as, Bloody Mary. Knox's choice of France as a place of refuge seems kind of odd, since things there were really little better than in England. Realizing that, he made his way to Geneva, where he met John Calvin. And Calvin described Knox as, quote, a brother laboring energetically for the faith, unquote. Knox was so impressed with Calvin's Geneva that he called it, quote, the most perfect school of Christ that was ever on earth since the days of the apostles, unquote. It was in Geneva that Knox also married his first wife, Marjorie Bowes, the daughter of the captain of Nordham Castle. They would have two sons together. Their marriage was a love match despite the disapproval of Marjorie's mother, who thought that her daughter was marrying well beneath her station. Knox was then sent by Calvin to the German city of Frankfurt to pastor a church of Protestant English refugees there. He quickly became embroiled in controversy. The Protestants couldn't agree on an order of worship. Arguments became so heated that one group stormed out, refusing to worship in the same building as Knox. Now, I mention this minor moment in Knox's life because it becomes sadly indicative of what begins to happen all across Europe as the Reformation spread. Once people split off from the Roman Church, they kept splitting off from each other. While it's difficult for us to understand this in our age of pluralism, the people of Europe in the 16th century assumed that you had to be part of some church, and that group was either allied with the state or wanted to be. There just wasn't a large block of people who were unaligned religiously. Atheism was simply not tolerated, and so once the monolithic hegemony of the Roman Catholic Church was broken, the cracks that formed in religious affiliation, they just kept going, you know, kind of like a cracked windshield. And the various groups thought that they needed to grab some of the power, or they would end up victim of someone else's power. This helps explain why the usually pacifist Anabaptists became militant in the city of Munster, as we saw in a previous episode. My point here is that the rift that formed in Frankfurt over whether or not to use the Anglican Book of Common Prayer and whether or not people ought to kneel while taking communion, it was typical of the battles that Protestants faced at this time. Now, looking back, we might, you know, shake our heads at such pettiness, but let's be careful. Do not our churches sometimes split over issues just as petty? We might think they aren't, but would believers 500 years from now say they are? I once began a Sunday message at our church in Oxnard by giving a half dozen absurd but real reasons that local churches went through a split. One of them was because people in a congregation could not agree on the color of a new filing cabinet. Of all the foolish things to split a church over. While Knox was in Germany, Protestants in Scotland redoubled their efforts and congregations formed all over the country. A group called the Lords of the Congregation vowed to make Protestantism the religion of the land. In 1555, they invited Knox to return to Scotland to inspire the reforming task. Knox spent 9 months preaching all over Scotland before he was forced to return to Geneva. There in Geneva, he published some of his most controversial tracts. In his admonition to England, he attacked leaders who allowed Catholicism back into England. In the first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women, he argued that a female ruler, like the English queen Bloody Mary, was, quote, most odious in the presence of God, unquote, and that she was, quote, a traitress and rebel against God, unquote. The unfortunate timing of this tract cannot be overstated. Knox published it in 1558, aimed at Mary Tudor, but Mary Tudor died that same year and was succeeded by the Protestant Elizabeth I, also a woman. Elizabeth never forgave Knox for his tract, even though he tried to explain that he hadn't meant her. The damage was done. This created significant problems for Knox and for Protestant-Catholic relations between Scotland and England. And another broadside, he extended to ordinary people the right, indeed the duty, to rebel against unjust rulers. As he later told Mary, the Queen of Scots, Quote, the sword of justice is God's, and if princes and rulers fail to use it, others may, unquote. Not really sure where Knox got that idea from scripture, since Romans 13 says that it's the duty of civil government to wield the sword, and citizens are to submit to that authority. It also says that vengeance belongs to the Lord. He repays. In any case, Knox made a case for rebellion against unjust government that many found to their liking. That principle would later influence both the English Civil War and the American Revolution. Knox returned to Scotland in 1559 and again deployed his formidable preaching skills to increase Protestant militancy. Within days of his arrival, he preached a rousing sermon at Perth against Catholic idolatry, which caused a riot. Mobs rushed into Roman churches, demolishing altars and smashing images. Knox later claimed that he never intended violence, but once you set a theological fire, it's hard to control where the flames go. In June, Knox was elected the minister of St. Giles Church in Edinburgh, where he continued to exhort and inspire. Now, in his sermons, Knox typically spent half an hour calmly exegeting a biblical passage, and then as he applied the text to the situation in Scotland, he vigorously would pound the pulpit, calling for people to immediately install the application. One observer said that Knox's preaching, quote, he was able in 1 hour to put more life in us than 500 trumpets continually blustering in our ears, unquote. The English, who were now under the Protestant Queen Elizabeth I, well, they came to the aid of the Protestant Scots, while the French, of course, aided the Catholics there. Fired up by Knox's preaching, the lords of the congregation armed themselves and occupied several cities. In 1560, at the Treaty of Berwick, the English and the French agreed to leave Scotland. The future of Protestantism was now safe in Scotland. The Scottish Parliament then asked Knox and five colleagues to write a confession of faith, the first Book of Discipline, and the Book of Common Order, all of which cast the Protestant faith in Scotland in a distinctly Calvinist and Presbyterian mode. The Scots Confession of 1560 was written in just 4 days, became the doctrinal foundation of the Scottish Kirk, another word for church, for over a century. Now, the first Book of Discipline, I have to say, was revolutionary. It called for universal education, with every parish having a school so that even the poorest children could learn to read the Bible. It also established a system of poor relief and proposed that the wealth of that had been confiscated from the Roman Catholic churches should be used for those purposes. Unfortunately, the Scottish nobles, who had taken much of that wealth for themselves, of course, they weren't eager to redistribute it as Knox envisioned. Knox finished out his years as a preacher at St. Giles, helping shape the developing Protestantism in Scotland. During this time, he wrote his History of the Reformation of Religion in Scotland. It was a first-hand account that remains an invaluable historical source, though admittedly it's biased in favor of the Protestant cause. Now, it was during this period that Knox had his famous confrontations with Mary, Queen of Scots. Mary was a devout Catholic who had been raised in France. But she returned to Scotland in 1561 after the death of her husband, the French king. The battles between Mary and Knox were epic. She summoned him to Holyrood Palace multiple times. In their first interview, Knox told the young queen that while he would obey her as a subject, he could not obey her in matters of religion where she contradicted God's word. Mary wept at that, whether from frustration, anger, or genuine hurt, we don't know. But Knox was unmoved. He told her that he was more afraid of tears from women than from armies of men, because women's tears moved men to foolish actions. In another confrontation, Mary accused Knox of teaching people to disobey their rulers, and Knox, in characteristic fashion, replied, quote, if princes exceed their bounds, madam, and do against that wherefore they should be obeyed, it is no doubt but they may be resisted, even by power, unquote. Mary understood this as treason. Knox saw it as just fidelity to God. Now, the clash represented more than personal animosity. It was the collision of two worldviews, divine right monarchy versus covenantal government under God's law. In 1564, Knox's wife Marjorie died, leaving him devastated with two young sons to raise. 2 years later, at the age of 52, he married Margaret Stuart, a distant relative of the royal family. Now, she was only 17. And that caused quite a scandal, with his enemies, including Queen Mary, mocking him for marrying someone young enough to be his granddaughter. But the marriage appears to have been happy, and they had 3 daughters together. Knox's final year saw his health declining. By 1570, he could barely climb the stairs to the pulpit at St. Giles and had to be helped up. His voice, once so powerful, could hardly be heard through the massive church. He preached his last sermon at St. Giles on November 9th of 1572. Knox died on November 24th of the same year, at the age of 58. At his funeral, the Regent of Scotland delivered a eulogy that has become Knox's epitaph. Quote, "Here lies a man who neither flattered nor feared any flesh," unquote. Knox's legacy is huge. His spiritual progeny includes some 750,000 Presbyterians in Scotland, 3 million in the United States, and many millions more worldwide. The Presbyterian system of church government that he helped establish, with elders and deacons elected by congregations, with regional presbyteries and the General Assembly, well, that became a model not just for churches, but for democratic governance itself. Some historians argue that Knox's emphasis on education, his establishment of schools in every parish, and his belief in the equality of all people before God laid important groundwork for the Scottish Enlightenment that would flourish two centuries later. Knox remains a controversial figure. His fierce opposition to female rulers alienated potential allies. His approval of violence against Catholics troubles modern sensibilities. His unbending personality created unnecessary conflicts. Yet his courage is undeniable. He stood before queens and told them the truth as he understood it, knowing it could cost him his life. His commitment to Scripture as the supreme authority, to the priesthood of all believers, and to education for all people shaped not just the Scottish church, but Scottish culture itself. When visiting Edinburgh some years ago, I had a chance to visit St. Giles. It's an impressive cathedral church. You can definitely see the difference from a classic Roman Catholic cathedral, which it was before the Reformation. But long Protestant occupation has removed many of the ritual furnishings of a Catholic church. Down the street from St. Giles is Knox's house, where he lived before being elected minister at St. Giles. He lived there when Catholics ruled, and he was banned from preaching in public. His multi-storied house juts out into the road, forming a little corner that traffic has to flow around, making something of a bottleneck. Now, Knox couldn't obtain a license for public preaching, but no one could stop him from saying whatever he wanted in his own house, and so Knox would open his window overlooking the street and preach fine messages, knowing that large crowds gathered outside to listen. He even engraved scriptures on the window frame. What's sad is that Knox's grave lies right next to St. Giles, but being some of the most prime real estate in all of Scotland, just a few yards off the Royal Mile, today it lies under a parking space. Seriously. There's an asphalt parking lot with white lines for cars to park. And smack dab in the middle of one of those parking spaces is a little plaque marking that this is the burial place of John Knox. Hardly anyone knows it's there. And perhaps that's fitting. Knox never sought glory for himself, only for God. He thundered against sin, confronted queens, endured slavery, and built a church that outlasted him by centuries. Whether you admire him or find him troubling, you cannot deny his impact. The Scotland that he helped reform, the Presbyterian church that he helped establish, and the principles of religious liberty and education for all that he championed changed the world. And that legacy cannot be paved over, no matter how many cars park above his grave.